Hi, I'm John.
And I'm Ron, and this is Digital Divination on the No Direction Network.
All right, we're back with episode 18 of Digital Divination, and this episode is immediately after Thanksgiving, so I haven't had a chance to talk with you, Ron. How was your Thanksgiving?
It was good. It was very good. It was just myself and, you know, my wife and our three kids, and I've had people say that, you know, it's a real shame this year for Thanksgiving because it's, you know, with a pandemic keeping everybody in, you know, as much lockdown as they can, their holiday meals are very sort of, you know, small and quiet. And with three preteens, my house is never, it's never small. It's never quiet. It felt like a very big rowdy Thanksgiving because it's big and rowdy all the time.
I think that would have been fun, you know, because it's just me and my wife now. My youngest is up in Calgary. My oldest is actually like an essential worker that works with people all the time. So there's no way we could spend time with them, though we did, you know, we made some leftover turkey pot pie for my oldest because she really likes it. And I actually like it a lot. My wife makes a really good pie crust.
Great.
And so that was really enjoyable. But you know, one of the things that I was thinking about, my wife has a sister in Utah. And, you know, Utah is actually not doing all that great per capita with this COVID stuff.
They're not. Most of my family's in Utah, and I hear about it every time I talk to them. My dad, my brother, yeah.
Well, but the kids are still in school,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, like face-to-face and everything. But they were having a big get-together. They had moved there from Arizona a couple years back, so they were having, like, four families over from other states and everything, and I'm thinking... Man, how I know it's like, this is how this spreads.
Yeah, we saw a huge uptick 2 weeks after the protests here in Seattle. We saw a huge uptick around the country in different parts of the country 2 weeks after Election Day, where everybody mm-hmm. was out voting. And I think 2 weeks mm-hmm. from Thanksgiving is going to be bad news.
I know, but it kind of, you know, when I saw that, it's like, oh man. This makes me feel bad because it's like I'm trying to do my part, right?
Mm-hmm.
And isolate, and it's not much fun, you know. And they are bringing people that aren't even in a social bubble or anything with them. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
You know. And so this actually got me thinking that, you know, I know other people that because my wife and myself isolate really pretty hard because of my medical situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, you know, we know other people that isolate hard. Maybe we should expand our bubble a little bit. And I actually made a last-minute call to our good friend Scott Keim. Because
he was in a bubble, you know, bubble of his own, really.
Yes, because he's always doing that bubbling. And I invited him over for Thanksgiving just to, because I actually had him over for Thanksgiving last year up in Camino. And so I thought, you know, we're going to start a tradition here in a pandemic or not. So it was kind of good.
So did he come by? Was he comfortable with that? And
well, he actually was more concerned about me. He had gone to the grocery store like a week and a half ago. You know, he's very careful when he goes in.
Right.
But that's the only time he's been out of his house. And, you know, I haven't been out like even that much in a long time. So we talked about it and, you know, we still kept some distance and everything up there. But I felt pretty comfortable because I know how conscientious he is,
mm-hmm.
and I've been very conscientious, and we talked about it, and we decided that would be okay, but we're not going to make this a regular thing.
Okay.
So right. We'll see how this works.
For the holiday, and...
Yeah, but, you know, I'm thinking this is the way that you more conservatively, carefully have somebody over, you know, find somebody who's literally been quarantining for months.
And then have them be the one person who,
yes.
Yeah, in the summer, yeah. I did a pretty good job of having, we had people over a couple of times this summer when it was warmer, because mm-hmm. we could have them in our yard and had, you know, like chalk on the ground, right? Because you can do sort of spray chalk on the grass. Okay, you're going to come in. Yeah. You're going to come in through the back fence, and you're going to come here to these chairs that I wiped down and have not touched in 48 hours and so on, so on. That way we were all apart and kind of shouting at each other across the lawn. It was at least some way to get together. I did hear in your voice some of the concern I've heard a lot of people say. Like, look, I'm trying so hard, and we're isolating, and I see people who aren't. And, you know, some people say, well, it makes me really think, is it even worth it, right, to be isolating to do even when other people aren't? And the best response to that I've heard is somebody said, you may have already saved somebody's life by isolating, and you just don't know that you did. So keep it up.
Oh, no, I know what life I've been saving. So I know.
It's very personal.
Yes. You know, being that I've been on immunosuppressants now for almost 6 months, I'm very, very aware of who's going to be really susceptible to it. And because of that, I'm also not catching it and spreading it and everything. So,
right.
So that's worked out well, but you know, it's different. And you know, the fact that all these people, you know, again, I get back to these relatives here. It's like, they can't put off one Thanksgiving. It's like, you know, I went to college away from home. I'm from this area here in Seattle. I went to college on the East Coast. I never came home for Thanksgiving. You know, I had to spend it with friends and do things like that. Yeah. When I was in the service, I missed lots of Thanksgivings and Christmases. And I was with a bunch of, you know, guys on a ship. And it's like, it's not that big deal when you can't spend a Thanksgiving, but still can talk to people on the phone and see them in a, you know. So I the sacrifice, I don't think is so great, yet people make such a big deal about it.
Yeah, it's people who've never had to do it before. I mean, people, like you say, people in the military, people who spend any time incarcerated, right? Mm-hmm. They miss holidays, right? And I've talked to some of them who are, you know, yeah, I mean, sure, it sucks, but it's not like it's not, I know it's something I could do under much worse situations than I'm living now. Right. So... Right.
Well, and I guess the thing that really gets me is like, you know, as a country, the COVID numbers are getting so bad. Now we've been desensitized to this, you know, it's like 160,000 new cases today. Ugh. It's like, oh, yeah, whatever. You know, it's like, this should be like shocking news to everybody that it's still way over the top, but we're just not thinking about it. But if we all isolated, if everybody stayed home away from everybody else for 14 days, we could like make this thing disappear so quickly.
Yep. Yep.
You know, get it under control anyway.
Right, right. You know? And then give time for the R value and all the other mechanics that you see along with it to have everything slowed so much that the vaccine will be able to catch up.
Yeah.
And our sort of the loss of people would be so much worse or so much better off. You know, one of the things that I heard that actually really woke me up is, you know, you hear the vaccines are coming out with that are, this one's 80% effective, this one's 90% effective, this one's 94%. And I was talking to somebody about how, well, 90% of effective doesn't sound great if you're the 1 in 10 people who's going to get it. And this person said, no, that's not how it works. 90% effective means everybody that gets it only 10% as strong as you otherwise would if you've had the vaccine. And that's phenomenal. Any vaccine with a 90%, if you could be guaranteed to get any disease at only 10% of the strength it was going to be, I mean, you'd be lining up around the block for that, right? So,
yeah, and they have a couple different mechanisms. You know, one of them, I guess, is like designed to train your body to fight it more efficiently. And, you know, so I almost wonder if they could make a, you know, a vaccine cocktail that took the best of all of them. Together, you know, so. Anyway, so that's, you know, Thanksgiving was interesting. It was kind of bittersweet. I didn't find any really great Black Friday sales or Cyber Monday sales, but you know,
we did. I think my wife found a lot of good. I think she probably found a lot of good things. The fact she was not very forthcoming about what she found made me wonder if she found things for me. but I myself had a lot of freelance writing to do this weekend for a lot of smaller projects that I'd gotten kind of somewhat done, and being able to knock out three different projects for three different companies even just made me feel super productive over the whole weekend.
Yeah. Yeah. That'll be some Christmas revenue coming in for
it. Well, or maybe a little bit later, you know. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I thought it was supposed to be 30 days from when you delivered. Wait a second.
That all depends on who you're writing for. That is what Paizo does. But yeah, I'm helping a friend of mine out who's actually going to be staging the releases in 2021. And because I get part of the revenue, it's not until the products that I've contributed stage and then he gets paid for them that it comes to me and so on and so on. So this is maybe some of the stuff I'm working is going to be part of the Christmas budget in 2021 maybe, but but we'll see. It's good to have it done. It's good to have an obligation finished.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. For, you know, I like having things completed, which is why I'm kind of bummed I haven't finished my grading yet, but I will do that tomorrow. I really relaxed a lot this weekend. I actually GM'd, there's a convention, Midwest convention called WolfCon Online. And I GM'd three games for that. I was only scheduled to GM two, but we have a full table. We're all set to play. We're talking. And the GM's computer shorted out.
Oh, no. Like
right before we were getting started. And it's like, I had very intentionally not read the scenario, not prepped it, done nothing. Because it's really rare I get to play something I have no idea about, right?
Right.
And then so we're looking around. I said, okay, let me ask around, see if I can get someone to GM. And I couldn't find anybody that was ready to run it. We had a table that could be transferred over to him on Roll 20. And I said, you know what? I'm not going to ask somebody else to do this cold. I told everybody else, if you guys don't mind, I know nothing about this. I'm going to be reading as we go, and I'm going to run this.
We'll all learn it together.
Yes. And it was actually kind of fun. You know, I have never run a game that cold before, ever, ever. I've always at least read something and had some idea what's going to happen. And this is like, every time I've read something, oh, that's interesting. You know, oh, okay. Oh, and I'm skipping through here trying to stay ahead. And I miss some certain details that come up later. So, oh, yeah, you know, back when we did this, I was supposed to say this. So let's go ahead and double back, you know. But it was kind of a good experience.
I've got a friend of mine who only runs anything in role-playing, he only runs it that way. He only runs it cold. And often when we're sitting down to play, it's the first time reading. He's run entire adventure paths and he'll be like, oh, we're sitting down. And as he's reading through the next chapter, we're going to get through that evening, right? As we go. And I think that there are people that really get kind of bothered by that, but he had such a gift of sort of engaging us with the story that when we did kind of the rewinds, like, oh yeah, the reason this, okay, this makes sense now because this dude that you met way back at this other place was actually an elf, and that's why these elves are asking about him. Oh, we're like, oh, I know. All right, then we sort of all, that all makes sense together, sort of eye-opening as a group. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's
I wasn't even able to read that far ahead. I was literally reading it as we were playing. So, you know, if I could have been 10 minutes ahead, because that's how I teach a lot, that's fine, you know? But yeah, you know, teaching as I'm learning something, that makes it tougher. So, but one of the things that came up though, and I thought we would talk about here is, you know, having prepped and ran something I wasn't prepped for. And now I'm prepping for our own convention here, Emerald Con, our Seattle Lodge. It's called the Emerald City Lodge. And we're running our very first convention here because it's so easy to do online. It'll be next weekend. And so I'm prepping for that. And I started looking at, you know, kind of the differences between what authors for society play kind of put in for their various encounters. And then I recalled, you know, we actually talked about this last week when I ran our AP, we had a certain encounter. And you said something that sometimes authors design things a certain way to make it, you know, more challenging, more exciting, more whatever. And I thought we could talk about that a little bit.
Sure, sure, sure. I think that one of the things that you mentioned is, you know, the actual design of it. I think that it's really easy. It's almost seductively easy to just pick a creature that's a couple CRs higher than the party's going to be and say, okay, you fight one of these, then you fight one of these, then you fight one of these, and just pull it all out of the Alien Archive. That generally makes for pretty unsatisfying series of fights. What you want to do is you want to be able to mix it up, not just between different numbers of creatures of different strengths or different sort of groupings of creatures, but different types of creatures that either synergize well together or don't synergize well together. Sometimes one of the plan, I mean, you could certainly have, all right, well, there's going to be a fight with a couple of thugs, and there's going to be two sort of beefy upfront melee fighters, and then somebody who hangs back kind of sniping at people. I mean, that's okay. They work together just great. But you could also have a different type of encounter where you've got a bunch of people who all want to fight at range. And so what they do in the encounter is scatter. And in the minds of the NPCs, each one hopes they're the ones that the heroes melee fighters aren't going after. So they could keep picking it off. And you can actually have, you know, sort of show off some maybe rivalry between the NPCs that way. You can make the encounter kind of interesting. And somebody who is, for example, if you've got a party where the first one they go after is the one with that great the one of that group with a great big sniper rifle. They're like, oh, we really feel like we got away with something because we didn't get sniped at from far away. Whereas the other one who went after the caster, you know, got you know, hit hard with the sniper rifles, but maybe took fewer magic missiles or whatever. People, the story comes out differently depending on how you approach that. I find that really satisfying in encounter design to think how many different ways different parties can come at the same encounter. Because if everybody's going to be kind of coming at the same, you know, if everybody's fighting, a mountain eel, it's all right. It's one mountain eel. People are going to fight it. You know, it's going to be kind of the same, and it's going to be the same way the party has fought other stuff. But if you diversify the different types of villains that you have in your encounters, you can really make something that feels unique to the particular table, because it is.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting you mentioned that. I'm thinking back to the encounter we had last week. And that was kind of a lot like you described there, where the first thing that they encountered was this giant dinosaur-like beast. I guess it wasn't giant. It was huge.
Yeah.
And but it was kind of a fiery variant of another beast. Looked a lot like a dinosaur, so we called him Barney.
Barney was purple. The image was purple. We couldn't not relish being able to take down Barney. Anybody with preschool age kids,
But what was interesting is that was such a challenging fight, in the way this particular AP was written, that there was another encounter that was within 5 minutes of that one ending. And that's pretty significant in Starfinder, because typically, because of your shared pool of hit points between stamina and your hit points themselves, typically you'd like to spend 10 minutes after a rough battle, go ahead and recharging that. And this particular author had designed it such that you did not get that 10 minutes.
Yeah, very, very intentional. You'll see sometimes in society adventures or any type of adventure that's sort of written with an eye toward low level or introductory type of play. A quick plug. I'm very excited for this. I saw the announcement for this go up that Starfinder's doing standalone adventures. And the first one is going to be a first level adventure. I can just about guarantee you that someplace in there is going to be something along the lines of, as the PCs go from this point to that point, it takes them at least 10 minutes, which means, GM, remind your players that they can now take their rest in order to regain their stamina, right? It's a way you want to be able to guide people to do that. I remember something that I'd written fairly early on in Starfinder, where I had two things that were about 10 minutes apart. An event that was about 10 minutes after another one. And some of the feedback I got is, nothing in Starfinder is about 10 minutes. It is either intentionally less than 10 minutes, or it is intentionally 10 minutes or more. We can't have a wiggle room for a very important number like 10 minutes.
Where does that come from, by the way? Why was the decision 10 minutes for that? Do you know?
I don't. And I actually think that something like 5 minutes is just as legitimate a choice. I think an hour might make people feel like they were kind of sitting around wasting a lot of time.
Right.
I do know, if I have to go back to some of the DNA of Starfinder, I go back into Pathfinder first edition, I go back into third edition and 3.5, and some of the, in I guess you could say, encounter duration powers that some of the classes in third edition, 3.5 had were 5 minutes. You do this thing and you can do it again. You can do it every 5 minutes.
Oh, right.
And that was as good as kind of, you know, elbowing you on the side saying, once per fight, right? That's what you get it for. And I think that 10 minutes is more conclusively a once per fight.
Right.
It's helpful because that also means that if you've got duration, like spell durations that are, you know, something like one round per level, it absolutely isn't going to carry 10 minutes. 1 minute per level, you know, maybe if you're high level, but not if you're low level. Everything, anything that's an hour or even an hour a level, oh yeah, you can have that through plenty of encounters. I almost wonder if a simplified spell duration or effect duration system would be to have the duration be, you know, one fight or more than one fight, right?
Right. Yeah, you know, that's kind of interesting. When you're developing for something or actually writing something, do you intentionally look at like how long it takes to get somewhere? Like, this will take you 8 hours, or this will take an overnight trip, or, you know, this is a 10-minute walk type of thing?
Yeah, I did some of that, and I have. One of the things to keep in mind for I had to keep in mind for the latest Starfinder project that I was writing, which is Planetfall. It's the first adventure in the Horizons of the Vast game, is that you've got these encounters separated by dozens of miles. So you can count on the fact that each combat is going to kind of be the only one of the day. Certainly going to be one that's several hours apart, even if you've got a ship to take you from, to hop from encounter to encounter. It's definitely going to be, you're going to be at your, pretty much your full strength in every fight. And I designed it that way intentionally with the fights that are a little more difficult. I don't think that it's really common to have a CR4 fight for first level characters, but I do that at least a couple of times because I know that you get the ability to not only take the fight at full strength, but in some cases, if you're paying attention to sort of clues you've gotten or your own scanners, you get a sense of what's coming. And so I feel like it can be something that's really tough. that allowed me to do two things. It lets me first, because there are the fights are tougher, there are fewer of them. And that means I can spend more words sort of building out unique monsters rather than having to rely. If you know there's going to be a lot of fights in a very short period of time and you've got to describe each encounter area, that eats up a lot of words. You don't want to spend your words on a lengthy, unique stat block. But this let me actually build some stat blocks. I think, you know, I have creatures that can kind of do fun things or interesting things that people don't expect, or they interact with the environment or with each other in neat ways.
Yeah. So when you're writing something like that and you're looking at the encounters, how do you just look at, oh, I have enough word count, I can make a new creature? Or do you have something else that, because when I'm looking at like some adventures, it's like, this is a standard creature that's right out of the Alien Archive. It kind of fits here. Whereas most of them though seem like they're customized for that AP. And so is it word count only that drives, oh, I need to take an off the shelf model versus my own version of it?
Yeah, I think it is primarily word count, because I can't tell you the number of times I have had to cut unique monsters out of stuff I've written and replace it with something from an Alien Archive, just because I was over word count, and that was sort of the easiest way to do it without sacrificing sort of fun role playing or some of the narrative background that was doing some heavy lifting. So that's actually, you know, makes me feel sad so much that I've been very careful about it in the future. And I've got a tendency to default to do the reverse, where I'll say, all right, well, I'll default to an Alien Archive monster. And then if I've got words left at the end, I will expand it out into something that's more unique. A mix of the two is absolutely important to keep players on their toes, to make it interesting for GMs. I think there is something to be said for, you know, if you're giving a GM an adventure that's just a bunch of linked encounters out of the Alien Archive, you know, why are they buying a 64-page book for that when they've already bought the Alien Archive? You could tell the story in substantially fewer pages. So you want to feel like the GMs are getting something. I do think there is probably a tendency in newer writers to kind of want to show off really tricky builds. And I don't know that does the game a lot of service. It certainly can. And I think if you're assuming experienced players, as is the case with a lot of high level play, that's actually kind of fun. But I think that one of the things that you want to focus on if you're writing low level stuff is you want to make sure that it's a it's not going to bog the players down with a whole bunch of tricky creatures with tons of special abilities that are all custom made. So,
yeah, and that's actually harder to GM as well, because then you know if it's a creature you've seen a lot, it's really easy to know what it does and prep for it and be ready. You know, if it's a creature that has all these unique abilities, then you got to go and make sure you have all those ready to go for when they encounter it, so you don't forget them, right? You don't just say, "Oh, it whacks at you. Shoot, it could have done this really cool soul drain thing this whole time, and I missed and missed half the flavor on that." So, so one of the reasons why I asked this particular question is I'm prepping this scenario, and it's interesting. It's a really long scenario, longer than most of them out there, and so now I kind of understand why the author did what they did. They have two big encounters in there that all use the same creatures between the first encounter and the second encounter, and then across the tier, so you have a low tier and a high tier, they use the same creatures, almost all the same, except just varying in numbers between them. And there's only like one new creature that is where they have a high-low version of it. Everything else is just the same version. And I think it's because this particular scenario is like way longer than most of them. It must have been running into word count issues that the author couldn't introduce a whole lot of different variants of it.
Well, and it's also to ease the GM. If it's going to be a complicated scenario with a lot of things going on, you want to make sure you're guiding the GM to use a limited amount of brain power most effectively in order to, keep track of points in some sort of subsystem maybe, or to keep several feuding NPCs' personalities straight. And so that's a reason where you might want to default to using the same monster, like you say, across different tiers and in several different encounters, because once the GM kind of gets, I see how these Ikeshti thugs are, okay, now I know when I use a bunch of them, for example, I know what they do, and I don't have to relearn a new creature every time those are coming up or across different tiers.
And that's actually nice for players. So like in the last book that you GM'd, you used a same flavor of creature a whole bunch in there.
Mm-hmm.
And or some variants of it. And after the first time we encountered and learned, what worked against it, what didn't, it was nice to know that. And then maybe if there's a little variant, we could cope with that rather than, oh, wow, this is a completely different thing that's impossible to defeat, which you introduced as well. But that there were not as many of those.
Right. I get one of the things that I've said for a long time as far as designing adventures, designing, in the basics of the game, is this game is the most fun when players get to feel smart. And so if you're giving them something brand new every time, they don't ever get that experience of, wait, we fought one of these and we learned how to defeat it. Let's apply what we've learned to make this encounter easier. When they do that, maybe some writers, maybe some GMs think, you're taking it too easy on your players. Well, no, you're letting your players demonstrate mastery, and they feel smart. They feel rewarded for what they've been through before, and that itself is a big positive when it comes to the fun of the game.
That actually works when you're teaching too. Like, when you're able to teach students something, and then when they get tested on it, they can apply it and show that they learned it. They're much happier than when you test them really, really hard and they still can't figure it out. And feel really bad. So there's a lot of parallels there.
Yeah, I can believe it. I've heard, people talk about, it's just this subject is, it's like learning. It's like trying to drink from a fire hose, right? You hear that phrase. That means I don't feel like I've been able to take what I've learned and apply it to new things. I feel like I'm always having to take things in. I totally can see that. So I can also see that you lean in the direction of making the students feel smart because of the type of preparation you've talked about. That you've talked about even here on Digital Divination, right? You've talked about how you want to have sort of this particular setup and how you teach, and you've got consistent methods that sort of carry on through. It's good. It's good to hear.
Well, I got to tell you, this whole online teaching thing, you know, so this fall was my first time, and I just finished it, and I adapted a lot as I went along, and I actually think it went better than I expected, only because I solicited from the students what was working and what wasn't, and changed it as I went along, which normally I don't do during the, normally I know what works and what doesn't work, and I kind of adjust for the personalities a little bit. Here, I actually changed a lot of what I did. This next term, so in January when I start, I'm actually going to try to, you know, kind of build upon what I learned to make it really good from the start. And that's a lot of prep to do that.
Yeah. I don't doubt it. Although this is kind of neat. This is you being a student, right? You're for the first time in how long you're sort of flexing quite a lot the educational parameters that have been working for you for a long time. You're kind of monkeying with those, I guess, in interesting ways.
Well, and that's the opposite of what you want to do when you're teaching. Is like, you like to get it set up where it's automatic, right? I've taught this class, like there's a class I've taught 17 times. That's one that I taught this term. You know, I've taught this class 17 times. I can walk in. I don't have to do any prep or anything. I just put my stuff up there, and it's engaging. It's fun. I know all the right jokes to tell. I know the timing to do it. All this kind of stuff, right? Now we go online. It's like, none of that works. None of that works. Oh, I have to, you know, it's like I'm a newbie all over again. And that's like the worst. It's the worst. So, you know, and I'm hoping, though, and so I'm investing some of my skill set here. I'm hoping that even when the pandemic is over and we go back to face-to-face teaching, that I'll still be able to carry over some of these things. And I do teach online in the summer typically. So to really enhance my summer teaching on a regular basis, I think would be good as well. So it's not going to be all wasted effort, but it's like, man, I'm going to be investing a lot this year. So, you know, I'm not hoping for the pandemic to last longer, but I'll be ready.
Well, and I certainly think the world on the other side of this is not going to be the world before it. I think that online participation in everything is going to be so much higher. And I think that there's, in a lot of ways, I feel like that's really convenient. I think for people that are less privileged, it's actually going to create more barriers. And we need to think as a society how to get around those. But it's going to be a different world for sure. And I can't imagine that you'll set online teaching preparation you've done aside and it'll gather dust and you'll never use it. I mean, you absolutely, I think, will continue to use it. So,
well, I hope so, because, you know, if I set it aside for a while, then when I got to break it out for the next pandemic, whenever that comes, it's going to be all out of date and I got to redo it anyway. You know, I got to stay on top of things here. Otherwise, it's not going to work. All right. Well, I think we've gotten far afield here. And I think that's about all we have time for today because of reasons. So I'm John.
And I'm Ron. And this is Digital Divination.